This is Trinity Church of the Vail Valley, loving God, loving people, and living free.
Welcome, everyone. This is Pastor Ethan, and today is Sunday, June the 12th, 2022. We have finally entered the home stretch. Today, we begin the 13th and final section of our journey through the book of Acts. Now, after today, we will have three more messages to complete the actual text, and then one more as a retrospective to see the biggest themes and takeaways from the overall arc of this amazing story of the birth and first generation of the church. And one of those big themes is a step-by-step trust in the providence and the sovereignty of God. We've seen how these first believers throughout the book of Acts, men and women alike, took each day a step at a time as they courageously walked in obedience to the Spirit's leadership. This is the trust that sustained Paul through his trials in Caesarea, and it will be this trust that continues to sustain him and those around him as he finally makes his journey to Rome. So, spoiler alert, this journey, the journey to Rome, it's going to be very, very difficult. You know, if we were to look at this story devotionally, right, it's a metaphor of life and God's relationship to us and what that all looks like. My friends, what Paul is about to experience here could symbolize the power of God's hope in the midst of life's greatest storms. Now, this is a big section of text. It's the entirety of chapter 27. And much of it details the sea voyage across the Mediterranean, but in these details are several key principles that we need to see, that we need to hear and wrestle with. So, strap in, place your trays and seats in the full and upright positions, and we will jump in as the journey to Rome begins. So we are beginning at the top, verse 1 of Acts chapter 27. And Luke the historian tells us, "When it was decided that we would sail for Italy, Paul and some other prisoners were handed over to a centurion named Julius, who belonged to the imperial regiment. We boarded a ship from Adramantium, about to sail for ports along the coast of the province of Asia, and we put out to sea." By the way, guys, there's a map that you can download. There's a link to it here on my sermon's website. And if you look at that, you'll see that they start the journey by moving north up the coast of Israel up until the area of Syria. Okay, so we boarded a ship from Adramantium. I'm probably going to really mispronounce some things in today's message. They boarded a ship about to sail for ports along the coast of the province of Asia. They put out to sea. And Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, was with us. Real quick, Aristarchus is one of those barely sung heroes of the New Testament. We first learn of him and a man by the name of Gaius when they were first captured during the massive riot in Ephesus. Now, Aristarchus was a traveling companion and friend of Paul and would go on to be imprisoned with him in Rome. Church tradition holds that he was martyred by Nero with Paul. You see, Aristarchus' name here reminds us that Paul was not a solo act. In virtually everything he did, he was accompanied and supported by a courageous and supportive community of faith. So, Aristarchus from Macedonia was with us. And the next day, we landed at Sidon, and Julius, the commander, in kindness to Paul, allowed him to go to his friends so that they might provide for his needs. So evidently, there is a community of believers in Sidon who helped Paul. Now, this is notable because we have no direct evidence that Paul had ever even been to Sidon. He may have, we just don't know it. But in any case, this speaks to how the gospel has spread around the Mediterranean world to many places that Paul himself perhaps had never traveled. Going on in verse 4. "So from there, we put out to sea again and passed to the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us." Okay, real quick, the lee of an island was the side protected by the island from the prevailing winds. So in this case, they were sailing on the north side of Cyprus, really between Cyprus and the northern Mediterranean coast. "When we had sailed across the open sea off the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra in Lycia. There, the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy, and he put us on board. Now, we made slow headway for many days and had difficulty arriving off of Cnidus. When the wind did not allow us to hold our course, we sailed to the lee of Crete opposite Salmone. We moved along the coast with difficulty and came to a place called Fair Havens near the town of Lycia. Okay, that's the first big part of the trip. So before we go any further, let's cover some basic information about this journey, okay? It is the autumn of AD 59. Now, this trip to Rome, starting where they were in Caesarea, under ideal conditions, would have taken about 5 weeks. But these are not ideal conditions. It's late in the season. Trips across the Mediterranean were typically not launched after mid-September and were absolutely avoided from November to mid-March. And we're starting this journey around mid-September. So the trip was moving into a dangerous time of year from the get-go. Now, we're going to be told a little later that there were 276 people on board the ship. So who was that? Well, of course, there's the captain and the crew. These would have been professional sailors. There's the ship's owner and a few passengers, including Aristarchus and Luke. Right? How do we know Luke is here? Because this is one of the passages where all of a sudden Luke starts referring to the travelers as we. Okay? We also have Julius, the Roman commander, and his soldiers. There are the prisoners, and among those prisoners, there is Paul. So Paul was a prisoner, but not just any prisoner. I mean, imagine that you are Julius or the boat captain, the ship's captain, learning that your job is to take this guy, Paul, across the sea to Italy. I mean, what do you know about him? What do you think of him? Well, first of all, you know that he's a Roman citizen and he's being sent to Nero. But the word is out that Festus and King Agrippa, that they thought he was innocent. So there's something mysterious about him. You know that he's a religious figure, he's a man of faith, but unlike any other that you've ever known. It seems all of Jerusalem is out to kill him. He's traveling under guard, and he appeared before both Festus and Agrippa. I mean, who is this guy? But Paul is also respected. This is key. He is not seen as a security threat or as a person that would try to escape. As we just saw, Julius allowed him to leave the ship. He was likely under some form of guard, but to go and seek out help from the community of believers in Sidon. You see, Paul is seen as a person of integrity and peace. And as the journey unfolds, he will increasingly be looked to for leadership, even though he is a prisoner. So as the journey begins, the conditions deteriorate, and Paul becomes the bearer of bad news. We're picking up in verse 9. And Luke tells us, now much time had been lost, and sailing had already become dangerous because by now it was after the Day of Atonement. So Paul warned them, men, I can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to ship and cargo and to our own lives also. But the centurion, instead of listening to what Paul said, followed the advice of the pilot and of the owner of the ship. Now, since the harbor was unsuitable to winter in, the majority decided that we should sail on, hoping to reach Phoenix and winter there. Now, this was a harbor in Crete facing both southwest and northwest. Okay, it's now mid-October, and we know this from the timing of the Day of Atonement, right? Also known as Yom Kippur, one of the most holy days on the Jewish calendar. Now, the seas are getting rough, and here Paul speaks up for the first time. We see here there's like this meeting of the ship's leaders. There's the captain, Julius, there's the ship's owner, and Paul. And guys, that Paul was included here indicates the respect that these men have for him. Plus, he was an experienced sea traveler. So speaking from his personal experience, Paul basically says, guys, we need to port now. We need to stop or we are all going to be toast. That's a paraphrase. But at least at this point, Paul's words go unheeded. The captain and the ship's owners are motivated, likely financially, to get to a port where they could properly unload the ship, secure the prisoners, and spend the winter. Not to do so could have jeopardized the value of the ship's cargo, not to mention the consequences they could face if the prisoners were lost. So they ignore Paul's wisdom and the worsening conditions, and they proceed. Now, Phoenix was a larger harbor, actually not that far away, about 50 miles west on the coast of Crete. And they believed they could make it. You know, just a 3-hour tour. Going on in verse 13. So when a gentle south wind began to blow, they saw their opportunity, and they weighed anchor and sailed along the shore of Crete. Before very long, a wind of hurricane force called the Northeaster swept down from the island. The ship was caught by the storm and could not head into the wind, so we gave way to it and were driven along. As we passed to the lee of a small island named Cauda, we were hardly able to make the lifeboat secure, so the men hoisted it aboard. Then they passed ropes under the ship itself to hold it together, because they were afraid that they would run aground on the sandbars of Syrtis. They lowered the sea anchor and let the ship be driven along. And we took such a violent battering from the storm that the next day we began to throw the cargo overboard. On the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither the sun nor stars appeared for many days and the storm continued raging, we finally gave up all hope of being saved. So friends, the situation here rapidly is becoming a worst case scenario. I mean, this drama can't be overstated, as the crew is literally fighting for their lives. Luke mentions here the sandbars of Syrtis, right? These were a known feature, a combination of sandbars and shoals, and in that time they were sometimes referred to as the graveyard for vessels. They lowered the anchor in an attempt to give the ship some drag, but it doesn't help. Finally, in an attempt to lighten the ship, because they would have been taking on water, they started to throw overboard the cargo and the tackle, which would have been any spare rigging and equipment, right? Some commentators think they may have actually thrown over the mainsail of the ship. Now, friends, Luke's statement in verse 20, it is emotional. The sun and the stars disappeared for many days, even as the storm continued to rage. You see, the absence of the sun and the stars, that wasn't just about darkness, although that was a big part of it. It meant they couldn't navigate. They were utterly lost. They had no gear, no sun, no stars, and no hope. They were done. My friends, you may have been in a place like this. This may be where you are right now, or it may be for someone that you know and love. You know, it's encouraging if we will look that Scripture never whitewashes the reality of human suffering and hardship and even desperation. God never asks us to pretend that things aren't the way they are, and God never says that we will be spared life's storms. Paul's presence here demonstrates this. Most importantly, though, God never condemns us when we feel like there is no hope. In fact, it is in places of total brokenness, when we are finally done fighting, that the mercy, the grace, and the hope of God are often realized. That said, it is also true that many people never recover from the loss of hope. You know, this year on March 7th, a person who had become a very close friend came to the place where he saw no hope in his storm and no way out. And my friend ended his life. I had talked to him the night before, and I didn't see it. Church, it is a profoundly difficult thing to walk with people in the depths of their pain. It is a courageous thing to ask God to give us the eyes to see, ears to hear, and the loving action to come alongside people, to listen to them, and carry hope for them until just maybe, by God's grace, they will be able to once again carry hope themselves. You know, a little less intense, but no less essential, is the call for us as disciples of Jesus to be self-aware of how our actions and words impact those around us. You know, we never really know what other people are going through. And what we say, where we say it, and how we say it just might be the light of hope for a person struggling with hopelessness. Or it may be one more stone pushing them away from hope and away from God. My friends, people are valuable and they need to be valued. Just one more thought on this. Friends, if you hear me there when we read Acts 27:20, where Luke says, "We finally gave up all hope of being saved," and in your heart you think, "That's exactly where I am." Friend, you need to hear the rest of this story. You see, everyone on the ship, with the possible exception of Paul, they concluded that they were done. And yet, they weren't. At the darkest point of the storm, Paul speaks up again, and he says, "This time, I have some good news." Well, sort of. Verse 21, "After they had gone a long time without food, Paul stood up before them and said," all right, real quick, parenthetically, you can translate what Luke just said, that they had gone a long time without food, as they had lost all of their appetites. They hadn't eaten in a long time because they wouldn't have been able to keep anything down. So on top of the total hopelessness that Luke is describing, they also were nauseated, dehydrated, and starving. And this is where Paul maybe not so gently reminds them, "You know, I think somebody told you that we should have stayed in port." He says, "Men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. Then you would have spared yourselves all this damage and loss." You know, Paul may have been rubbing their nose in it just a little bit. I mean, he is human. But more likely, he is making a case here for his credibility because he has something crucial to say, something that they need to hear. And now we see Paul moving to the center of these events as the person who is keeping hope alive. And his message? Friends, we are all going to survive. But the ship is toast. Verse 22. "But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Only the ship will be destroyed. Last night, an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve stood beside me and said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar, and God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island.'" Men, this is going to be very difficult, but we will make it through it. Friends, what was the source of Paul's courage? It was God's promise that he and everyone with him would make it to Rome alive. You know, there's a subtle note here, but it's very important. These men weren't going to survive because of Paul's faith. You know, God had said, "Paul, this is what I'm going to do. This is the reality. You all are going to survive, and you're going to Rome. There's no way around it." You know, God's will here would have happened whether Paul believed it or not. You see, what Paul's faith did was give him courage, as by this faith, he believed that what God said was true was in fact what was already true. You know, in Christian culture, in a lot of Christian teaching, we tend to emphasize the idea that by faith, we move God to do things. Right? If we have enough faith, we can say, "God, this is what I really would like to see happen. This is what needs to happen. This is my issue." And God will act on it. But if we look closely at the New Testament, we will rather see that faith is the gift by which we enter into and experience the good of what God has already done. So Paul doesn't sugarcoat the situation here. The ship is going to be lost. We must run aground. We must crash. And yet, there is great hope. So take courage. You know, it's often said that extreme crisis can make us religious, can make people religious. And this seems to be the case here. For as the situation worsens, we find the crew praying for daylight. Starting in verse 27. "On the 14th night, we were still being driven across the Adriatic Sea, when about midnight, the sailors sensed that they were approaching land. They took soundings and found that the water was 120 feet deep. A short time later, they took soundings again and found that it was 90 feet deep. right? The bottom is coming up. Fearing that we would be dashed against the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern. The stern's the back of the ship, and they prayed for daylight. Okay, basically, land is approaching fast. It's night, and they can't see where they are going, so they drop all their anchors in an attempt to slow down the ship. But the sailors themselves have little hope that this is going to help, because at the same time, we find them trying to abandon the ship. Verse 30, in an attempt to escape from the ship, the sailors let the lifeboat down into the sea, pretending they were going to lower some anchors from the bow, from the front of the ship. Paul sees this, and he said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless those men, unless these sailors stay with the ship, you cannot be saved. So the soldiers cut the ropes that held the lifeboat and let it drift away. Guys, do you see this? Paul has now gone from a person who was ignored to the one giving orders. Paul's hope and courage gives him the peace to be level-headed when everyone else is panicking. And it is here that Paul speaks for the last time. And in an incredible scene, God uses Paul to bring a renewal of hope. Picking up in verse 33, just before dawn, Paul urged them all to eat. For the last 14 days, he said, you have been in constant suspense and have gone without food. You haven't eaten anything. Now I urge you to take some food. You need it to survive. Not one of you will lose a single hair from his head. And after he said this, he took some bread and gave thanks to God in front of them all. Then he broke it and he began to eat. Oh, friends, think about what that would have been like. I mean, all hell is breaking loose. The ship is literally starting to come apart. And in this most desperate moment, Paul tells them to eat and to take strength. You see, at his command, the remaining food was brought forth. And with the deck now crowded with exhausted men, Paul gives what may have been the most powerful testimony of his life. In the midst of the storm, with everyone watching him, Paul breaks a piece of bread and he gives thanks to God. And the result is that his courage spreads to everyone else on the ship. Verse 36, they were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. Altogether, there were 276 of us on board. And when they had eaten as much as they wanted, they lightened the ship by throwing the grain into the sea. And so now, all that is left is the shipwreck. Picking up in verse 39. When daylight came, they did not recognize the land, but they saw a bay with a sandy beach where they decided to run the ship aground if they could. Cutting loose the anchors, they left them in the sea and at the same time untied the ropes that held the rudders. Then they hoisted the foresail to the wind and made for the beach. But the ship struck a sandbar and ran aground. The bow stuck fast and would not move, and the stern was broken to pieces by the pounding of the surf. The soldiers then planned to kill the prisoners to prevent any of them from swimming away and escaping. But the centurion wanted to spare Paul's life, and he kept them from carrying out their plan. Here at the end, when it seems that just maybe they will make it to shore, even hanging on to bits of wood, all of a sudden the lives of the prisoners are in jeopardy. Fear of what would happen to themselves if the prisoners escape lead the soldiers to try and kill them. But then, at great risk to his own life and his own career, Julius the commander prevents this massacre from happening. And he does so. Friends, he does so because of his great respect for Paul. So Julius ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and get to land. The rest were to get there on planks or on other pieces of the ship. And in this way, everyone reached land safely. My friends, that's an incredible story. So let's look at this through the lens of what we can learn, how we can be encouraged from what we see here. You know, lessons from the storm, as you will. And the first is this. Guys, it is wise to listen to wisdom. Early in the journey, Paul had offered wisdom based just upon his experience of growing up around and sailing on the Mediterranean. And his wisdom was ignored at great cost. You know, wisdom is a gift, even though at times it can be hard to hear. Yet Scripture is a treasure trove of wisdom. And as we learn increasingly to humbly trust God, we will be less inclined to ignore wisdom. You know, because we're fighting so hard to make things work the way we think they are supposed to work. We are able to lay that down and trust God. We will be able to hear and receive wisdom to a greater extent, and it's a gift. You know, in the midst of the storm, it is wise to listen to wisdom. First big takeaway. Next, we see here the great lesson that our hope is not in our ship. Our hope is not in our ship, whatever your ship may be. Now, hear me. Guys, ships are great. They are good, useful. They can bring us lots of joy, practical use. Our ships can make us feel secure. We can bless others with our ships. God will use our ships for his purposes and his glory. The problem is when we let our ship become too important. Then the ship can become a source of pride, stress, and identity. We tell ourselves, if my ship is exactly how I want it, then I'll be content, then I'll be happy and at peace. You know, sometimes we care too much about what other people think of our ship or how our ship compares to other people's ships. We can get ship envy. Worse, when the weather does start getting rough, we tend to think, my ship is what's going to save me. Now, guys, make no mistake, having a seaworthy ship is a good thing. But if our faith is only in our ship, we can get into trouble because life may bring storms. For many of us, life will bring storms that our ship simply cannot handle. And if our hope is only in our ship, we may conclude that we have no hope. But church, ultimately, our hope is not in our ship. When we come to see and trust the good news of what God has already accomplished in Jesus Christ, what is already true of us in Christ, then we can come to experience the hope, the redemption, and the peace of our loving Father who has not left us alone. So what is your ship? But far, far more importantly, friends, what is our source of hope? Better said, who is our hope? Church, hear me. When your hope is in the miracle that Christ gave his life for you so that he could place his life in you in order to express his life through you, that is not just some spiritual concept. That is a source of incredibly practical power. The practical power of Christ in you. This is the next big principle we see. You know, what did we see in this story, specifically when we look at the dynamic between Paul and Julius? Friends, when we are living in dependence upon God, trusting him, and our lives are increasingly characterized by his nature, we will have a positive influence on the people around us. Maybe a life-saving influence. I mean, think about it. On this ship of 276 people, it's likely there were only 3 believers. But we don't find these 3 believers off by themselves, hidden in a room praying for deliverance. I'm sure they were praying for deliverance, but they weren't seeking to save themselves while the rest of the ship just went to destruction. No, they were right there with everyone else, right there with these Roman soldiers, with the prisoners, and these sea-hardened sailors. And because of Paul's visible and consistent presence of courage, integrity, hope, and his testimony, he imparted hope and courage that saved the life of everyone on board. My friends, the simple and humble expression of Christ's character in our daily lives, that is a powerful thing. And it just may be that the most powerful attribute of Christ's nature in Paul was when he, in the midst of the storm, when he was thankful, when he expressed the miraculous power of gratitude. You see, for Paul, Luke, Aristarchus, and everyone on the ship, that night was the most extraordinary extreme place of their human existence. Physically, emotionally, and mentally, these men were overcome with darkness. And there in that place of hopelessness, with everyone looking to him, Paul looks to his Father. He looks to his Father in whom he trusts, and he gives thanks. And friends, that was the turning point. Immediately, Luke tells us, everyone was encouraged, and they began to eat. My friends, there is so much anger, fear, and hurting in our society and in many of our churches. When the people in our circles of influence, when they look at us, what do they see? What do they hear? Because make no mistake, people are watching us. And some may be looking to us for hope. It may be our children, our grandchildren, coworkers, maybe our employees, maybe our friends and neighbors. And when a person looks to us and they see gratitude, this is a powerful thing. In the midst of the chaos of life, gratitude is a living testimony that points toward the hope within us that is greater than the storms around us. Let me just end with this. In 1834, an English pastor named Edward Mote wrote a song that went on to become one of the most beloved hymns of the church. Now, his original title of the hymn was "The Immutable Basis for a Sinner's Hope." But we know the song's title by the song's opening line, and it's this: "My hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. For I dare not trust the sweetest frame," right? "I dare not trust the sweetest ship's frame, but I wholly lean on Jesus' name. For on Christ the solid rock I stand, all other ground is sinking sand, all other ground is sinking sand. And when darkness hides his lovely face, I rest on his unchanging grace. For in every high and stormy gale, my anchor holds within the veil. And his oath, his covenant, and his blood, they support me in the whelming flood. And when all around my soul gives way, he then is all my hope and stay. For on Christ the solid rock I stand, all other ground is sinking sand. All other ground is sinking sand." Friends, may it be said of us. Church, I love you, and I'll be right back here with you again next week.